It's not as simple as it sounds, because I remember him like we was walking. He walked through the hall. He said, "Jonathan, I'm going to New York." It was on a Wednesday. "I'm going to New York Friday. I want you to come with me. Pack your bag, and Saturday we can drive to Connecticut. I'm gonna turn you pro." He just turned around and walked away. I'm like, "Wait, what?" I did. Yep. It was like a balloon pop, man. But it made it like a bittersweet victory, because you want to be happy, yep. But yet it's really your moment to grieve type of thing. He's the one who put in our head, everybody that we fight. Listen, he said, "Y'all listen, everybody." He said, "We crunk, okay?" He said, "Man, you wanted us to go out there, right? Everybody, we getting them out of here. I don't care who they are. We getting them out of there. We going to hurt everybody. We going to get them out of there. We ain't going distance with nobody."
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Holyfield was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's bitten me. He's the one that put you back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning, and there's nothing else.
Hello, welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week I'm joined by former cruiserweight contender Jonathan Banks, who has become a Kronk stalwart for several decades, carrying on the work of the late, great Emmanuel Steward as a trainer. Banks was a fine fighter, but his path took him into training before he was done as a boxer. When Steward became ill, Jonathan picked up the reins of Vladimir Klitschko and others, and he took a break from training Gennady Golovkin recently for his trilogy fight with Sal Canelo Alvarez to record this podcast. Banks was funny and interesting, with a real passion and historical perspective in talking all things Kronk, Detroit, Emmanuel Steward, and much more, and I really enjoyed this conversation. A reminder, guys, as I do say some from time to time, I do have a Patreon account. You can follow me at patreon.com/TrisDixon to get these episodes early and advanced, and there's also plenty of episodes of Ringside Rewind up there, the new podcast with myself, John Rawling, and Ian Dark. I have been under the cosh of late, working on Warrior, Matthew Saad Mohammed, a champion's incredible search for his identity, which many of you will know has been a project that's close to my heart, and something Matthew and I agreed to do in 2001. Obviously, Matthew passed away in 2014. But that book is now done, written, and is with Pitch Publishing for editing to be released in October. Before we get going with Jonathan Banks, I just want to say, as always, huge thanks to my sponsors. Hanson Lee Resourcing were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert, impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And now here's Jonathan Banks.
So tell me, how fulfilling is life as an ex-fighter who has become a trainer? We hear about the fighters who missed the buzz of fight night. Do you get that buzz now being a trainer, or do you miss being a fighter?
I think I will always miss being a fighter. Because like any issue for me was never solved through negotiations, and I gotta wait for a guy to come to the gym, or I wonder if this guy go show up. It's so much I don't have to worry about. You know, I didn't deal with spar partners before I was a trainer. My brother did. My brother asked me who I want, and I told him, "Well, this is who I want, go get him." And like, it's a lot of stuff I never had to deal with. You know what I'm saying? But so it's completely different. But do I miss the fighting part? Yes, I do, because I miss it a lot because somebody in the gym talking junk, you tell them to glove up and let's go. Now it's all settled. Ain't got where, yeah, whatever they go say, they already said that the business is handled. Everybody cool again. Yeah, let's go. You know what I'm saying? But that's going to be forever. I'm going to miss that because that was what the fight part is what drew me to the sport.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I was a kid in Detroit. I just wanted to fight. I love boxing. So I just wanted to fight. So that's what drew me to the sport. And that's been the best thing for me.
Do you get the buzz when you walk down with your fighters, say on, you know, in a couple of weeks when you walk down to the fight with Gennady against Canelo, are you going to be getting a similar buzz? You know, even though it's not you going into the ring.
Oh, my buzz come from training camp, man. I'll be like, oh, man, I want to, like, let me glove up. Let me wrap my hands and glove up. I wonder, like, if this guy don't do good, I'm gonna get in there and show him what he should be doing. You know, but that the buzz is to that similar. But by the time the fight night come, it's all about my fighters. The thought of me don't even enter my head. It's all about him. It's all about everything I need to do to make sure we get the win. Because at the end of the day, that's what really matters.
So what was the hardest part about walking away and why did you decide to go when you did? Because you had more left in the tank, right?
I feel I do. But when the call came to train, start to be a trainer, I had no idea what I was stepping into. You know what I'm saying? I had no clue. But when it came, I accepted the challenge. But I thought it was going to be a one-time thing. I thought the late Gertie Van Stewart would come out the hospital all fine and dandy and keep training his fighters. I never thought that this was an opening, another door opening to a new path. I didn't think that.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and I've seen why no fighter has ever done it before. Because it breaks your hands down so much fast, especially when you're dealing with a big guy like Vladimir Klitschko. You know, him hitting the first time I ever gave him pad work is when he asked me to train him. I've never given pad work before. What I know about pad work? I know what it looks like, you know what I'm saying? But no, I never done it before. When I first did it, he was just so sure that I was the guy for him. So, but the more I start doing it, next thing I know, when I'm starting to punch things, I'm starting to feel like my hands starting to hurt a little bit. So it kind of broke my hands down a little bit, like as far as from punching to giving mid work. So it's a tough task because if you got a fighter in training camp for let's say 8 weeks, then you leave that camp, go to another camp, then leave that camp and go to your camp. Like, it's just too much.
Yeah, of course. Okay. And how are you holding up now with your hands and shoulders and elbows and everything?
I'm good, man. Everything is great. Yeah, everything is great. We got no problems or no complaints.
Hey, going back a few years, maybe even many years, you wouldn't have all got this. You wouldn't have got any of this if you were still playing the piano. How did that all come about with you playing the piano?
Fred is laughing at me. My mother, when I come from a family of 10, more than 10 children. Very, very small house, one bathroom, 3 bedrooms. I would wake up in the morning to the sound of her playing the piano. Her favorite at the time, her favorite artist was Mahalia Jackson. And she would play gospel songs on the piano. And those are the first type of songs I learned to play because of her. You know, I would hear the piano, and then as soon as you hear the piano, you smell breakfast cooking, you know what I'm saying? Like 5:30 in the morning or something. You know, because everybody had to get up extra early because there's a lot of people that need to use the bathroom to get off to school. You know what I'm saying? So, but that's where the interest came, and that's where the love of the piano, because I got to the point where I would sit next to her, and I try to play with her. You know what I'm saying? So even when I get home from school, you smell dinner on the stove, and she playing the piano. And I try to, some days I try to, you know, play next to her, you know, because, you know, you're a kid. So, yeah, you want to sit down and try to play the piano. So that's where the love of it came from.
Did you get good?
I was getting there. I even took a piano class in high school.
Okay.
You know, so I could learn the notes and what I was doing and stuff like that. I was playing a couple songs, man. I was getting there, but I said, you know what? I just stopped doing it because I was like, I don't know why. I still like it to this day. And one day I said, I'm gonna get me a keyboard to travel with, a small keyboard to travel with. But that's gonna be a while for me because I don't want Fred talking about it too much.
So how did you get into the boxing? How did that come about? How did you first go to the gym and the first time? What made you go?
Boxing is something I always wanted to do. Even through piano, I always wanted to do it. Like that was the first thing I ever wanted to do. And I remember I might have been between seven and ten, something like that. Baseball coach came to the house and asked my mother if I could join the baseball team. And she like, yeah, but you know, what he really wanted to do is the box. So don't be upset if he only do one season of baseball, don't go back. And I had an uncle that had a friend that used to box. And he told him, and he told my mother about a place that I can go sign up the boxer. And coincidentally, it ended up being the same place Ray Robinson started training at, same place Joe Louis started training at, and it's the same place Emmanuel Stewart used to box at. It was on the east side of Detroit, Carl Brewster Center. And that was 1996 when I first started training.
Wow, not a bad breeding ground there, the Brewster Center. Wow, that's phenomenal. Good stuff. So were you good at it from the start, or did it take some getting used to?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, the thing about it, though, like, I don't think I was good at it, but my coach, actually, my first trainer, my first trainer used to tell me, he told me his boxing background. He was the old Detroit heavyweight, and he fought Muhammad Ali. His name was Alvin Blue Lewis. That was my first coach. And he said I was doing good. And like, I was down there for like maybe 2 or 3 months. And he asked me, did I want to fight in the Golden Gloves? I'm like, yeah. He said, you sure? I was a shy kid, but I never shied away from fighting. I'm like, yeah, I'll fight. He said, you sure you want to fight? I'm like, yeah. So, and coincidentally, that's how I ended up meeting Matt Stewart, because he wanted to know who was the 147-pounder who won the Detroit Golden Gloves. That was me. And I was able to be introduced to him from that point. So, I was 2-0 with 2 knockouts. So was I good? I don't know. But I was punching him, so I was winning, so I was happy.
So tell me about your amateur career. You were 3-time National Golden Gloves champ, right?
No, I never won a Golden Glove National.
Okay.
I was I should have had to fight one. Oh my goodness. I don't want to talk about that. Oh my
no, go on, go on.
I went through a week-long tournament, fighting every day. Out of 5 fights, I had 3 knockouts. Oh my goodness, man. I was just running through the competition. I loved it, man. We was at the Orleans and Las Vegas. I will never forget it, man. And I talked to Emmanuel the day before the championship, the Jonathan. They're telling me you're shooting to win the championship, man. He said, you got a nice little bonus coming for you once you get this one. I was like, oh man, I can't wait, you know. But anyway, it was right after this 9/11 stuff, man. and I fought an army guy. Why did I do that? I beat the brakes off this guy, and they didn't give me nine. I got maybe 1.5 points the whole four rounds. I said, there's no way in the world I can't gun the ring with Superman and only hit him 1.5 times. Like, are y'all kidding me? But that was that ruined my National Golden Glove dreams. And the next tournament after that was the Pavs. And that was a national tournament as well. And I said, you know what? It was the ringside tournament after that, then it was the Power Nationals. I went to both tournaments and I won both tournaments.
Okay.
I won both national tournaments. Cause I just couldn't believe they took that one from me, man. I was hurt. I said, you know what? Only way you get back is you gotta go get back. So it was a beautiful thing because we was amateur. It matters, but at the end of the day, it's the decision of the point system. It really matters, but it don't matter. It's the experience you get as an amateur. And the whole thing was just awesome to me.
So that was kind of my next question, Jonathan. Was it fun back in those days, the amateur days, being an amateur out of the cronk?
Oh, my goodness, man. Listen,
were those amateur days the best days of your career, the best days of your life, some of them?
It was some of the best days of my life. Some of them. Not the best days, but some of the best days. Because we would roll up in the city, and everybody see all the gold, all the red, trimmed in blue. They'll see it, and people will not like it at all. It's man, y'all think y'all this, y'all that, because he managed to do it. Man, a lot of people liked this, a lot of people didn't, you know. But the one thing they were saying about everybody that was in those uniforms, they said, y'all better take this fight seriously, because these dudes can fight. You know, that was it though. They knew we could fight, so that was the major thing. But the best days was in the most innocent days. Like you're not used to traveling. Like for me, 15, 16, 17, traveling all around like that was amazing to me. I would have never been able to travel like that if I wasn't boxing. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I never would have been able to travel like that. Like, to be a kid from the inner city, to be able to start traveling through the country like that, like, oh my goodness, man, it was unbelievable for me. I'd come back home. I used to take those cameras, you know, take a picture, you rewind it back.
Yeah, yeah.
Once I got my film developed, I showed I used to sit down with my mom at the table and say, look, I was here. I said, I got this picture of Buckingham Palace, and we went inside, we got this. Oh, and I met the Lord Mayor this year. When we was in England, they got us all up to go to meet the Lord Mayor, and we took a picture. We went inside his place, like all that. It's like, man, like, because wasn't nobody in my family traveling. Like, I was the first one to start traveling, man. So, especially for me to get a passport around 16, I'm like, man, it was something totally different. You know what I'm saying? But the whole family was totally different. You know, so I come back with nothing but stories.
So were you always a good kid, or did you get involved with the wrong crowd at all?
I was mixed up in the wrong crowd quite a bit. I mean, think about it. Okay. And to me, it wasn't the wrong crowd because these were my guys. I knew these guys, man. But at the same time, I knew what they was doing. And so I made a choice a long time ago, and I chose to stick closer to boxing than the friends. And the more I traveled, the more I came home finding out that this person was killed, this person was killed, this person was killed. And I'm like, you know what? Yeah, I'm gonna leave that. I'm gonna leave a lot of those little things alone. And stick with this boxing thing because, like, it makes no sense, you know. So that for.
So for a bit, I mean, you were. I'm not going to say involved, but you saw some of the gang stuff that we hear about in Detroit and that kind of stuff.
I've seen a bunch of them, like a whole bunch of them. And man, you got to think about it. The Kronk gyms, like. Man, It was full of gangsters down there, man. You know what I'm saying? Like it was crazy all around. We was in gang affiliated territory. That gym was gang affiliated territory. You know what I'm saying? So we was always walking through the heat, so to speak, in and out the gym.
Sure. Did you get in trouble? Or did you make your mind up before you got in trouble? No, you got in trouble.
Got in quite a bit of trouble. So man, got into some trouble.
Okay. Hey, I bet you don't, you know, obviously when you talk about, you know, this guy died, this guy went to jail, that kind of stuff, I bet you're quite pleased with your life decisions now, right?
Man, of course. You know, my mother was always the key piece of that, because she had not only me, but she had 9 other children that she was raising. So it wasn't just me. So she was super, super strict. You know what I'm saying? She didn't play. I was telling guys that a couple weeks ago, I was with Badu Jack and a lot of his guys, okay? And they were talking about hip-hop songs, stuff they grew up listening. I said, man, majority of hip-hop songs I heard it away from the house. My mama wasn't playing that stuff. You couldn't play no hip-hop stuff in the house. She wasn't playing that. Because at the time, hip-hop was gangster music.
Yep.
And she said, I ain't raising no gangsters. Y'all not bringing that in here. If I hear it, whatever's playing is going in the trash. Like, she wasn't playing it. Like, she wasn't getting no phone calls, collect calls from a jail cell. Like, my mom, like, she wasn't playing it like that. So we knew when we got caught up, like, we went to jail, my mom was the last person I'm gonna call. I'd rather sit here than call her, because I know it's gonna be a problem if I call her. Like, seriously. Like, if I got in trouble at school, they ask me, who you want to, we go call the police or call your parent. Anybody else say call your parent? I said, man, you call the police. I'd rather deal with them. Like, y'all do not know what I got to deal with at home. Do not call my mom.
Did any of your siblings go the other way with gang life?
I mean, some of them dip their foot in it, but you know, fortunately, they never stuck. It never stuck in there.
So, and how about this? Obviously, hey, boxing's a dangerous sport. What did your mom think about you doing that? Was she cool with that?
My mother loved every bit of it. She used to watch. My mother used to watch boxing with her father when she was living.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying. So she was all into like wrestling. Like I got other brothers that started karate when I was. I think I was like 10 or 12, they started going to karate. So, I mean, we was always into the physical sports. So she was never afraid of us doing it. She's just the type of woman that was always praying for our safety. She didn't want us to get seriously injured or seriously hurt or stuff like that. But that was about it. She always was pushing us to do whatever, like, you know, our choice was to do, as long as it was something positive.
So when you turned pro, how far did you think you could go in the sport?
I mean, I was with Emmanuel Stewart, so I didn't care. You know what I'm saying? Like, I knew I'd go as far as he would take me. I'm like, I'd go as far as he'd take me. That's how I felt about it. Because, like, I just believed that whatever he said. I just believed him.
And I suppose that gave you massive confidence, right? Because if someone like Emmanuel Stewart's with you, you know he's not going to waste his time on a 4-round fighter, right? You know that he believes in you.
Exactly. And plus, he like, not only, like, he showed me a lot, like, being in Lennox Lewis training camp, talking to me about different things, being in Vladimir's training camp, being just in different training camps, and he putting on. I remember he was training Jermaine Taylor. He like, come on, let's go to Memphis, Jermaine. He wanted to train in Tennessee, so let's go here, let's go there. Been a lot of different camps with him. So we was able to do a lot of talking, a lot of different things. So it was all special moments, because training camp was the time where we really sat down and was able to continue long conversations.
Yeah. So how long did it take for Emmanuel to win you round? Obviously, you say he came looking for you after he heard that you won a tournament. Did you buy into what Emmanuel had to offer straight off the bat?
Straight off the bat. straight off the bat. When I joined his amateur program, I had met him once, but I joined the amateur program. Sugar Hill was actually over the amateur program.
Yeah.
That's how me and Sugar Hill got to travel so much together to different tournaments. He was over the amateur program. And so about right around maybe 17, 18, I ended up moving in with Emmanuel Stewart. And I was able to continue to travel with him even as an amateur, because when he leave to go to training camp and we got a tournament coming up, he would call us and he'd be like, listen, y'all need to come to training camp and train for y'all tournament.
So when you turned pro, were you a full-time fighter? You didn't have any other jobs or anything like that? You weren't working?
Full-time. Well, I was traveling around.
Yeah, that's it. You need to be here, there, and everywhere to spar.
Yeah, these camps. Yeah, I'll travel with him. And think about it. It's not as simple as it sounds, because I remember him like we was walking. He walked through the hall. He said, John, I'm going to New York. It was on a Wednesday. I'm going to New York Friday. I want you to come with me. Pack your bag. And Saturday we could drive to Connecticut. I'm going to turn you pro. He just turned around and walked away. I'm like, wait, what? I said, hold on. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, hold on one second. So that's the type of guy he was, man. You know, you just got to just be ready and stay ready around
him. Yeah. Oh, man, that's cool. So, yeah, Andy Lee's told me some of these stories. Like, you know, the phone would ring or he'd be there and he'd be like, oh, I've got to go to HBO. I've got to go here, there, and everywhere. And he'd be like, yeah. Grab your bags. Let's go.
Yeah, HBO calling. Got to go. Hey, gang, let's go. So, yeah, it was something special.
Hey, so when you were around, like, any Lennox camps and stuff, were you involved in any way, shape, or were you just involved, or did he just say, come check it out, see how it
runs? I was just around. I was just a kid. I was just an amateur boxer looking at a world champion conduct this camp and just do different things in camp. It was an amazing experience, though.
What did you think, you know, a kid from Detroit, like you say, in a city, what did you think of Lennox and how he carried himself as a human being and a guy who played chess and all the rest of it?
Yeah, Lennox was super cool, man. He was always a cool dude. You know, we didn't have a lot of interaction with him, because a lot of times he was in the gym and we wanted to bother him when he was in the gym. But we had a lot of interactions with him. You know, and he was always a cool dude, always.
And in terms of, you know, you being a good amateur, someone who experienced a lot in the Kronk, what did you, like, learn from your first sort of 10 fights as a pro? Because you had things pretty much your own way early on in your pro career. Were you learning stuff? And what are you picking up in those early fights?
Yeah, of course. You have to. I mean, the whole professional thing is a learning curve. Because, I mean, you don't know to be a professional until you're a professional. You know, you don't know how it feels until you're actually, you know, in there. You know what I'm saying? So the whole thing is a learning curve, man. The whole thing is a learning curve, man. I definitely enjoyed every bit of it.
We've heard about the Kronk Wars. Who have you had Kronk Wars with? Who would some of your all-time great spars been against or with?
You know, I had a war with Monty Barrett.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. We went to trade left hooks, and his landed first and put me right on my butt, man. Oh, my goodness. I was so mad. And Emmanuel said, don't worry about it. I said, don't worry about it. Everybody's around here. He just dropped me. What are you talking about? Don't worry about it. You know what I'm saying? I had a war. I had a crazy war with Richard Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Richard Hall. Oh, my goodness, man. We went at it. I was still amateur at the time. I think I was like 17 or something like that. But I had a lot of little things down there, man. It was something special. Guys I never would have normally been in the ring with, you know what I'm saying?
What about some of the better spars you've seen down there?
Oh, my goodness, man. I seen Michael Moore, Henry Akiwande. Oh my goodness, man! It was insane. It's just man. So many different guys that came down there. Prince Nassim was down there hurting guys, shooting guys, turning softballs, being softball, shooting guys, hitting guys with right hooks, dropping. I mean, it was something special down there, man. The type of guys, but some of the best wars that we've actually seen, some of the best boxing we've seen was just regular local guys that was just down there.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? There was just that soon as somebody new came in, they yelled out fresh meat. You know, somebody like Prince Nassim come in, then somebody yelling out fresh meat. Like, they don't care who you are. You come in and you knew you fresh meat.
And you would have also seen this many times over the years, right? Where you had these good local guys and they were brilliant in the gym, but they didn't deliver in the ring, right, as well.
Quite a few of them didn't.
Yeah.
But there was they are the reason so many champions was created down there. Like, a lot of people dog those guys, but those guys are very much needed, because if you don't got top-notch sparring partners, it's really hard to maintain titles these days. Yeah. Or any other day. You know, it's really difficult.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So your big step up came against Alicia Castillo. His only loss had been to Vlad, and he'd beaten Michael Mora. So tell me about the Castillo fight, because you were down early in that fight.
Man, I was down too early. I was down in the first round, man. Oh my goodness. That was the last fight conducted at the original Crown Gym.
Okay.
The last televised fight, as far as the training goes, that was the last fight conducted at the Crown Gym before it was torn down. Wow. That was the last fight. And Sugar Hill and I was training down there because he was off doing HBO and he was off somewhere else. So Sugar Hill and I was training down there. And I remember the day they closed the doors. We left and ended up going to another gym on 8 Mile to finish the rest of the camp. And about a week later, we on our way to New York for the fight. So, but that was the last fight that was conducted and trained down there at the original Crown Gym.
Wow.
And, but that particular fight, it was different, you know what I'm saying? Because I know I'm on the canvas and I know I'm getting up, and I survived the round. And the crazy part wasn't even the first time me being knocked down. That wasn't even the crazy part. The crazy part was I sat down on the stool, Emmanuel put his hand on my head and I said, "Good job. Way to hold on. That was a really good job." I'm like, "Wait, what?" I'm like, "I got knocked down. I was that good." But that's the specialty of Emmanuel Stewart. He could take a bad situation, turn it good, just like that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I never thought nothing else about the knockdown. He said, "This is what I want you to do now. I want you to get out there." And like, he just explained what he wanted me to do and just went out there and did it. I said, "Okay." I forgot all about it. I wasn't even concerned with the knockdown. I wasn't even shaky to go back in there. I never thought nothing else about the knockdown until after the fight. Once the fight over with, I talked to my brother. I'm like, "Man, what the heck happened? That was crazy." You know what I'm saying? But he took that away from me. He dealt with that burden that I had to deal with. That's what made him so special. You know what I'm saying? Whatever, he knows the interaction of what's needed instead of what someone may want. It was that's one of the special gifts that he possessed.
And you stopped Castillo in 4 rounds. I had mentioned Michael Mora then. I bet you got some crazy Michael Mora stories. You must.
not a lot, but Michael Moore disappointed me one time. I was like, right after he, who he beat? Beat Holyfield.
Yep.
And he's heavyweight champion of the world. And he came in my family's restaurant right on 7 Mile in Detroit. And I was so excited to see him. And he looked at me like I was a piece of linen carpet. And I was so upset. And then, once you fast forward, maybe 5 to 7 years later, maybe, I ended up knocking out the guy he lost to. And I made a fundraiser in Chicago. And guess who come walking through the door? I didn't even see him. I heard him call my name. Jonathan! Turned around, it was Michael Moore. And I thought to myself, payback would be real good right now. Because I thought about the little boy that looked up to him, that he was heavyweight champion of the world. You know what I'm saying? But, yeah, I didn't. I said, you know what? I'm going to do something that he didn't do. You know, and I came in and embraced him and all that stuff. So it was cool.
Did you ever spar him?
Michael Moore, no.
Okay.
This was stop me from sparring Michael Moore. I saw him in a ring spar. He was sparring one of my guys. And he walked up to the guy that was sparring, and he did. He went like this and did one body shot and broke his ribs. I said, I ain't sparring him. And I was 17 years old. I'm like, I'm not sparring this guy, man. Like, I was, at best, I was 180. My heaviest, like, I was 180 at the time. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, I'm not sparring him. Like, this is crazy.
Hey, so after the Castillo fight, when you boxed the likes of Sebastian Hill, Zach Page, Ralph Reimer, how come you didn't get a title shot? How come it was taking you a while? Because that Castillo fight should have got you right up and amongst those guys.
Well, I was ranked number one for WBO.
Yeah.
And they had it all set for a main event in England for Enzo Magnelli. And Enzo Magnelli postponed the fight twice. And at this time, I'm in Mallorca, Spain, training with Vladimir. And I'm getting ready for the Enzo Magnelli fight, and Vladimir getting ready for whatever his fight was. And I was going to leave from Spain to go to England to fight, then I was going to rejoin camp. And I twist my ankle running on the golf course. So they said, you still want to fight? He might be like, I'm a little skeptical because I don't want you going there with an injured ankle, because if you lose because of the ankle, then like, why rush to fight if you don't have to? I'm like, yeah, but I think I can do it. He said, I'd rather you not. I'd rather you go in, especially if you had a sore arm, but an injured foot, and movement is a part of everything you want to do. So we chose to postpone the fight. So during that postponement, everything was okay. It's fine. Once I was back 100%, came back to camp, and they postponed it twice more. They kept postponing it, and Emmanuel said he just got tired of waiting. So he ended up talking to Mr. Lindsey Tucker from the IBF, and he was like, well, Jonathan is a highly ranked cruiserweight, so I mean, I'm pretty sure he can fight for any title. It's not just the WBO. So that's when he said it'd be easier to get this fight out of Mac in New Jersey for the IBF. And but I didn't know. That's when the IBF just came up with that. You can't gain more than 10 pounds within 24 hours of your weight. And I had no idea how to deal with that. Like, you know, that was the worst thing that ever happened. I hate that route.
We'll come to that in a sec. So what did you make of Enzo Macronelli, by the way? What did you think of Enzo as a fighter?
I thought he was a good fighter. I was looking forward to fighting. thought he was a really good fighter. Yeah, I thought it would have been a great fight. I thought it was, I was looking forward to taking on the challenge. It was like it was going to be really good.
And then you mentioned obviously that you were in camp with Vladimir around this time, around about this time. How close were you and Vlad at this time? And had started to give you some training responsibilities?
No, it wasn't. Like I was, me and him was just I was sparring at the time. I was a sparring partner.
Yeah.
It was Chris Bird. He was getting ready for Chris Bird.
Okay.
That's who he was getting ready for. Rematch against Chris Bird. But no, me and Vladimir, man, we was bonding closer and closer at that time. And like it was an awesome situation. He was rebuilding his career and I was just getting mine started.
Don't take this the wrong way. Were you a better sparring partner than fighter when you were given the amount of work you had to do as a sparring partner and the different weight classes that you had to operate as? And I suppose feeding into that, did we ever see the best of you or was the best of you done behind closed doors?
I think I was a better fighter than a sparring partner.
Yeah.
I think so. You know, but because, I mean, majority of my sparring days was done getting ready for a fight anyway. You know, I was never traveling around sparring just to spar. You know, every time I was sparring, I was getting ready for a fight.
Yeah, sure. Get ready to peak for a fight as well.
Exactly. So I would have my certain days that I would spar, certain amount of weeks or whatever. So that's how it was for me.
So you also mentioned that in the amateurs, you like traveling stuff. Have you always liked the traveling? Because obviously Vlad's training camps were in Austria and all over. Have you always enjoyed that, getting around?
I mean, I fell in love with it and I got used to it. I mean, because like I used to talk about and tease my mother because I'm like, everybody got their special cake on their birthday. Like, we never really got presents, man. Like, my mother couldn't afford to get us. Like, so one thing she'd make our favorite dessert on our birthday. And I'm like, even to this day, my little brother get his pineapple upside down cake like clockwork. his birthday is October 12th. October 11th, that cake is ready in the microwave, all packaged up, ready to go. You know what I'm saying? He gets the whole, I'm like, I can't believe everybody get their favorite dessert. I'm like, where am I at? You know, she's like, well, you was never here on your birthday. You know, I missed a lot of birthdays because of that travel situation. But I learned to fall in love with traveling. I fell in love with it because it was something so different for me. You know what I'm saying? It was an educational thing. It was a life experience thing. It was so different. I never thought that I would see so much outside of my neighborhood as much as I did. And once I started seeing it, mentally, I just started growing. And I just always wanted to be traveling. Right? It was crazy.
So you're going to have to answer this now because everyone will be asking this. So, so what is Jonathan Banks' favorite dessert? What were you missing at that time?
I don't know, man.
come on, it must be. You disappointed me.
It's difficult. Favorite dessert, like from with my mother. Oh my goodness, my favorite dessert. If it's a birthday, then you gotta get me a chocolate cake.
Okay.
You gotta get me either German chocolate or double chocolate. But if it's a holiday, like I ask my mother, like, "Mama, you got any desserts for the holiday?" She's like, "Why? What do you want?" I said, "Can you make a bread pudding?" Like my mother make a bread pudding. Just like if I call any sibling right now and say, "Mama's making either a bread pudding, banana pudding, or like a peach cobbler or something." I guarantee, if I tell them today, I guarantee you any amount of money, by the time that dessert is done, either she have 20 missed calls or she have at least 20 cars circling her house. I guarantee it. Like, hands down, guaranteed.
Hey, so this kind of feeds into my next question, right? So how torn were you between cruiserweight, light, heavy, and heavy? And obviously, you know, you sort of tried your hand at all three weights. Was it tough? And obviously, you mentioned there in terms of the weight, not necessarily the cut for Adamek, but not being able to put loads back on. So was weight making a big issue in your career?
It was a big issue at every point, from the amateurs to the pros. I mean, I had no, like, this new nutritionist thing that came up about 10, 12 years ago. Like, if I had any of that knowledge, like, oh my, I could have saved myself a lot of time and a lot of pain. You know what I'm saying? Because making the weight and rehydrating yourself back to where you can be and you can perform is it's simple now, but it wasn't simple then at all. I just didn't know how to do it.
Sure. You were at the bigger end of boxing, and you know, I've done this with Chris Bird quite recently, this podcast, and he was saying that PEDs were everywhere and he was offered them a lot and stuff. Did you come into any contact with them? Were you offered them? Do you think they're a big deal in boxing now?
They are a big deal in boxing. I was never offered them personally, but I seen people use them, you know, in different places that I was at. And I'm just like, it was always taught to me that every man go off this. Like, dude, if you got the heart for it, you don't need nothing. That's how we all grew up, you know what I'm saying, in the city, in the Kronk gym. Like, man, like, If you got the balls, what you need juice for? You know what I'm saying? That's all we needed. You know what I'm saying? Like, we didn't need nothing else. Like somebody in school talking junk through the window, what you need a pencil for? Like, dude, you got the heart, yeah, or go outside and fight a man. That's how it always was for me. So I never, like, that PED stuff, I never thought twice about it, because I'm like, man, like, I don't care about that. Like, if you want to fight, at the end of the day, somebody can win, somebody can lose. But we go fight them, so let's go do it. So yeah, I never, like, that was always a weak spot for me, because we grew up like, man, we don't need no weapon. Like, we got our fists, that's the weapon. Let's go, you know. So it was never even nowhere near a question if I would do anything with it.
So were you a heavyweight who had to cut to get to cruiserweight, or were you a cruiserweight who had to put on weight to get up to heavyweight, or were you somewhere in between?
When I started off cruiserweight, my first fight was like, I was like 190. You know what I'm saying? But my body was continued to grow. And once I started getting comfortable around 210, 202, 11, it was so hard to cut those extra 5 pounds that, like, I'm like super weak. And I just didn't know how to do it. So I just told, in 2009, I'm like, I got to go to heavyweight. I said, I can't make the weight no more. And that's when I chose to go to heavyweight. 2009, my first fight at heavyweight.
You'd obviously sparred a lot of heavyweights, but what's it like when you're a cruiserweight trying to mix it up with heavyweights? Does it feel a lot different?
It was always beautiful, man. Like, I tell any, like, cruiserweights, the reason heavyweights like smart cruiserweights is because if the heavyweight like good competition, he likes the speed of the cruiserweights. Cruiserweights is always faster than majority of your heavyweights, you know? So I used to have fun smart heavyweights. Always did. It was fun for me.
And you mentioned the Adamek fight, by the way, in 2009. Two things. What was he like as a fighter? And what was it like going into the Prudential Center, which was a bit of a stronghold for the Polish fans at the time, right?
It wasn't a stronghold. It was Poland. They just so happened to land it Billy in America, but that was Poland. Listen, I've been to Poland. I've been to Warsaw, okay? Yeah. I've been to the arena when Vitaly fought Adamek in Poland. I was on the undercard. But I fought in Poland. I've been to Warsaw. That arena in Poland and that Prudential Center is no different. Only difference is when you go outside. That's the only difference. One, you go outside, you're in Jersey. The other, go outside, you actually in Poland. That's the only difference. It was pure Polish. Everything about it was Polish.
Hey, so let me ask you about a couple of the guys that you didn't fight back in the day that maybe you could have. Steve Cunningham.
Oh, my goodness, man. I was chasing him. That was my Evander Holyfield to Mike Tyson. How Tyson looked at Holyfield, that was Holyfield to me, Steve Cunningham. That was the top of the iceberg. If I could fight him and beat him, I'm like, man, that's the best cruiserweight in the world. That's how I looked at it.
What about David Haye?
David Haye was more in England. The only reason I knew about him because I traveled so much with Vladimir. Like, we never really looked at him in America until he ended up fighting, until he ended up getting that Showtime fight with McAnally. I think that was McAnally he got there with. He didn't get the undisputed title, but they claimed it was undisputed.
With McAnally.
But David Haye was a hell of a fighter. I was more so worried about like the actual guys that I come up around. But David Haye was a hell of a fighter, man. I always loved seeing him fight.
What about Marco Hook? Were you ever close to that fight?
I was never close to that fight. By the time Marco Hook started making a lot of noise, I was not cruiserweight no more.
Right, you got up.
But Marco Hook was a hell of a fighter. I like Marco Hook. You know, I liked him.
Hey, so you boxed Paul Butlin on the big Klitschko-Chagaev bill. That was supposed to be Klitschko-Hay. What was that like? Because that was a huge outdoor bill. Did you like that? Did you? When we talk about the traveling, it's great experiences. You mentioned Poland. This is a huge outdoor fight. I think it was Dusseldorf. These are a lot of boxes that people tick in their career, right? Wanting to box in big stadiums and all that.
Right.
Is that how you see it? You know, they're all achievements.
Man, to me, it was. It was a beautiful thing to be able to fight on his show, and to fight, get my hands wet with the heavyweights. I was excited about it.
And then you beat Travis Walker, and then you had a surprisingly tough time with Jason Gavin, who people thought that you were gonna beat comfortably.
And that referee, if the referee would have called the knockdown, it would have been different. But I ended up messing up my shoulder that fight. And that was the worst pain I've ever been in my life. Oh, that was one of the worst goals I ever had.
And we mentioned Haye there. You were in Munich when Vitali fought Derek Chisora. And that was the day, that was when Chisora slapped Vitali at the weigh-in, spat the water at Vladimir in the ring. And then Haye and Chisora had the press conference brawl. How was your weekend that weekend?
That was a crazy weekend, man. It was violence everywhere. I'm like, this is crazy. I'm like, man, I didn't know stuff like this happened over here. Like, this is crazy. Look at this. I felt like I was home or something. Fight breaking out here, fight breaking out there.
So let's go through those. What did you think of Chisora slapping Vitali?
I wasn't surprised. Because I'm like, Chisora go do something. Watch. You go do something. Because he always to the point where this dude think of getting the edge. So he got to do something. You know, so I thought he was going to push him. I didn't think he was going to slap him like that. It's crazy.
What about when he spat the water at Vladimir? What did you think about that?
I said to myself, Vladimir and Vitali is really, really in sync with each other, because there's nowhere in the world that could have happened to my brother and that fight still would have went on the same. They really think big picture. Really. They have to think big picture, because that was an insane situation. Spitting in my face.
In front of the world.
I think my reaction would have been the same whether you did it in the closet when nobody could see, or if you did it off stage in front of the world. My reaction would have been the exact same. I take hats off to both of the brothers, man, because that discipline they have for restraint is insane. It's unbelievable.
And where were you when David Hay and Chisora were having that brawl? Were you there?
Where was I? I was there. I don't know how close I was. I don't remember how close I was. I remember everybody running and screaming. I remember running and screaming. They were running. I'm like, what am I running for? I didn't hear no gunshots. I'm like, what am I running for? Like, I didn't understand it. Like, oh, yeah, I'm running. Anybody shooting? They just said, hey, nah, they're fighting. I said, that's all. They're just fighting. I said, oh, okay. And ain't nobody shooting, so I wasn't worried about it. Happens.
So you handed Seth Mitchell, who was a former football player, you handed him his first loss. And that was about a month before Emmanuel passed away, I think, right?
Oh, my goodness, man. That was a month after.
Okay.
Me and Sugar Hill went to the funeral, buried Emmanuel. That, I want to say, was that on a Saturday? No, it wasn't Saturday. It was on a Tuesday. Because the Saturday before the Tuesday we buried him, I was in the corner with Vladimir. We flew back to the States. That Tuesday we buried Emmanuel. That Wednesday I was on a plane going to New Jersey. The following Saturday I was in the ring with Seth Mitchell.
So your mindset has to be incredibly strong, because obviously you lost Emmanuel, who would you say a father figure? Certainly a mentor.
Oh, yeah, he was everything, man. Yeah, 100%. 100%.
And yet, not only did you fight 5 days later, but you upset Seth Mitchell, who was probably favored ahead of you at the time at heavyweight, right?
Yeah, he was way ahead of me, yeah.
Tell me about that. What was that, like a siege mentality where like Emmanuel's gone, these guys aren't picking you to win, you got nothing to lose, and you just box well? Like, what?
I didn't think none of that. Honestly, man, I didn't think none of that. I honestly, like, I could make up a story that's going to sound so great that I could predict this when I was this age. I could, but in all honesty, I was doing everything I can not to deal with not grieve of Emmanuel's being gone, because I had no time for emotions. You know what I'm saying? I had no time for it. I had to train Vladimir for the first time. This is my first fighter I ever trained. I'm like, okay, everything I'm doing off muscle memory of what I saw this man do. Everything I did was strictly off what I saw. You know, it wasn't nothing about me that made this situation so much. It wasn't nothing like that. You know what I'm saying? So that was that right there was one of those roller coasters of emotions that you had to tug down, bury, and put away. You know, and the crazy part about it was, every afternoon after breakfast, for the next, well, we was in camp for like 30 days after breakfast. Like, it was me and Sugar Hill in the room. Like, he had come back to my room instead of going to his room. Like, I don't know. It was just that was a bond moment that we shared. Doing that training camp, doing that particular time, and it was something else, because my day started at my day started at 6 because I had to train, and then Vladimir come in at 8, then he trained. You know what I'm saying? So after I finish with him, I go eat, try to take a nap, come back. My day started at what? Want to say 1:30 or 2. And Vladimir coming to the gym around 4:30. So it was a long situation. His fight week was my last week of sparring. So I had to bring all my sparring partners to his fight week. You know what I'm saying? So it was a crazy situation.
So when you'd beaten Seth Mitchell, could you let it out then?
I did. Yep. It was like a balloon pop, man. But It made it like a bittersweet victory because you want to be happy, yep. But yet you really is really your moment to grieve type of thing. You know what I'm saying? So it was like a bittersweet situation.
And the person you want to share it with isn't there to share it with, right?
Exactly. The person I want to call so bad to give me some blow by blow, commentator by commentator reaction. Somebody I could just go, let's go, just call and say, come on, we about to go get some soul food. You know what I'm saying? Like, not there no more. It was quite an empty space for a long time.
So you actually dropped Seth Mitchell three times, stopped him in the second. You lost a rematch a few months on. What was different second time around?
No idea. Just being honest, man, I don't know. Like, I remember hitting him and hearing two cracks, and I'm like, okay. And when I went to jab again, I was just in excruciating pain. Like, why my hands hurt so bad? Yeah, I don't know what the problem was, but yeah, no.
And you broke your hand. And you broke your hand.
I fractured both of them. I'm just like, I wish I would have broke them because they would have went numb and I could have just let them go. You know what I'm saying? The break is better than the fracture because you feel every inch of the fracture. Once you break it, most of those nerves go numb. And you just let them go, and it's whatever happens, happens. You know what I'm saying? But the fracture, like the bones and stuff like that, it was a horrible feeling.
So, and then there's only the Tarver fight left after that. So that Tarver fight comes a couple of years on. How did that come about? And had you retired?
No, I was training. I was trying to space train my training camp and my fighters' training camp.
Yeah,
because at this point, I have I'm training Vladimir Klitschko, Dillian Whyte, and Cecilia Brecht, and I have to find a way to space these camps out because like they're coming too close. So I think I had a break and I'm like, man, I want to fight. Let me get a fight. I want to fight. And that's how it ended up happening.
So you were working with Vlad, obviously now at this point towards the back end of his career. How had he changed from the fighter Emmanuel had rebuilt to the boxer that you had? Did he still have hunger and desire to achieve
stuff? A lot of hunger, a lot of desire. But only method I had that I wanted to change was Emmanuel always told me that he got to find a way to get Vladimir more aggressive. I said, why don't you just tell him? He said, Jonathan, I can't. He said, because for me to rebuild him, I had to keep him safe first. And once he adapted to being safe, I can't just go back and change everything. I got to slowly do it. I'm going to find a way to slowly do it. But that's what I want. He said, maybe if you start training him, that's what you can get out of him. Get him to be more aggressive. And I would lie. I was like, man, I ain't going to never go train this dude. What are you talking about? He said, that's just a thought. You never know what happened. He just walked away. I'm like, why would you leave me with that? Like, really? And after the first fight, I started thinking, like, you know what? Emmanuel did tell me he would like Vladimir to be more aggressive. Okay, that's my next challenge. How can I make Vladimir more aggressive? And two fights later, Vladimir said, JB, let's talk. I said, all right, what's up? He said, you're making me more aggressive. I said, huh? He said, I'm throwing more punches than I normally throw. You're making me more aggressive. I said, well, that's what he might want. He said, really? I said, yeah. He said, why he never tell me? I said, it was too late. I said, he got you into one particular style and you fell in love with that style. And it was nothing you could do to change it. He know how stubborn you are. Now, you weren't about to change that. You know what I'm saying? I had to give you something to challenge you without telling you what I was doing because you were not wanting to do it. That's just how you are. You know, it's a lot of... That was the talking with... Going through... Listening to conversations between Emmanuel Lennox, Emmanuel Vladimir, Emmanuel Vitaly was a lot of psychological warfare things that I've learned over the years.
Sure.
Because everything was psychological with these guys.
Sure. And, I mean, the Vladimir things really... I mean, I suppose that there are obviously comparisons with Vladimir and Lennox and what they overcame and the boxers they turned into, right? Where Emmanuel was telling them both to pull the trigger in fights and they were reluctant to do it more often than not, right? which is funny because that's the complete opposite of the Kronk mentality, right?
It is. You know, it is. But the most thing they have in common is they both, he got both of them after knockout losses.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one thing they have in common. But Lennox knockout loss wasn't as bad as Vladimir's, or maybe it was. I don't know. Knockout loss, in my opinion. But
yeah.
They both show major grit and major intelligence in their career, in my opinion. You know, I always looked up to both of them. Lennox was the first guy I've been around. He was the first guy I was around, and I knew like this dude's making millions of dollars, and like he was just down to earth, man. And then you got a guy like Vladimir. He was making millions of dollars, and he was like one of the most down to earth guys. Like, you know what I'm saying? The way they embraced me was unbelievable for me. So it was awesome. I enjoyed the journey with them.
So this training role you have now, this wasn't always your long-term vision, but maybe it was Emmanuel's long-term vision for you.
Right. Exactly. That was the best way you could put it.
Yeah. But we've also seen this Kronk resurgence, obviously, with you, Joey Gamache, Andy Lee, Harold Knight, who's obviously from the Lennox days as well. And Sugar, what does it mean to you when you see all your contemporaries and all the other Kronk guys lifting the brand again? You must get a buzz out of that, right?
A 100%. It's almost to the point where it's like everybody is agreeing to pay forward to what Emmanuel Stewart instilled and what he brought to the world. You know what I'm saying? So that's always my goal. Is everything I do. It's like the things I was given, like pay it forward. You know what I'm saying? Like that's always the thing. That's why, you know, my team is working tirelessly to open up this community center in the city of Detroit to continue to pay forward the things that was done for me. And it was, I tell people like all the time, like if this knowledge that I have cost, I never would have it. If I was charged for it, I'm sorry, it did cost, but if I was charged for it, I wouldn't have it. You know what I'm saying? I couldn't afford nothing, man. Are you kidding me? I couldn't even afford a bad pair of boxing shoes. Come on, man. I wouldn't have it. So. Paying things forward has always been a key essential in my whole life. Everything I do has been that.
Are there any Kronk stars that we know about who could have been good trainers among the guys that I mentioned that never went the training route, that they could have actually, if they thought about it, then they would have made good trainers?
I was talking to a guy the other day on the phone that I think if he wanted to, could have made a good trainer. Might have heard of him, I'm not sure. His name is Thomas Herman.
Okay.
Yeah, I was talking to Tommy, man. Number one, it's always good to catch up with him. Number two, I think if Tommy wanted to, you know what I'm saying? But most guys that get that big, it's really difficult for them to settle down into one particular group to say, okay, this is what I'm gonna do right now. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So it's because they star power will always be a part of their lives. So I think it'd be more difficult for him to do that. But I think he could have been a good one, because when he traveled with us, he gave us so many good pointers. Mel McCord, former WBC welterweight champion, he traveled with us as amateur. He's the one who put in our head, everybody that we fight, listen. He said, y'all listen, everybody. He said, we crunk, okay? He said, man, you wanted us to go out there, right? Everybody, we getting them out of here. I don't care who they are. We getting them out of there. We going to hurt everybody. We'll get them out of there. We ain't going to distance with nobody. You know what I'm saying? That was the speech he gave us, man. And it was unreal how it turned everybody around. Everybody just saying, all right. Everybody just had this aggression going to so many different tournaments. Like, we getting them out of here. They get... That was the whole theme. Every van, like, we got three big 1500 vans full. You know what I'm saying? When we go to a gas station, the first thing I look at just like, we getting them out of here. That was the thing. But Emmanuel knew who to put around us to help this amateur program grow. He did that, and that was another part of his genius, man. It was unreal.
You had mentioned Dylan White there. What was your Dylan White experience like?
Dylan White is one of the most talented fighters, man. He's so talented. He's really gifted, man. Long arms. He ain't too tall. He ain't short. He's really rangy. He got really good power on the end of his punches. Really, really good. Really, really athletic and really good. Really good. I had a good time with him. You know, I had a good time with him.
And now you're working with Gennady Golovkin. Tell me what your relationship is like with Gennady. How did that link up come about?
Just he called, said that he's looking for a new trainer. Asked me, you know, I was one of the names, and he asked me, will I be interested? I'm like, well, the interest is there. And, you know, they said, well, why don't we arrange for you? Let's talk. Let's arrange you come to L.A. for a second, for a couple of days, and let's have a conversation. I said, all right, it's not a problem. I'll be available this day, and, you know, we'll see if we take it from there. And they said, okay. And it was really that cut and dry.
So we kind of alluded to this with Vladimir when you took on Vladimir, and obviously he was kind of setting Emmanuel's ways rather than your ways. There is obviously this old saying, right? You can't teach an old dog new tricks. Is that the case in boxing?
It depends on who you talk to, honestly, because I think the mind is a beautiful thing. And it could, and it's forever evolving. And as long as the person is willing to work, something can change. That's my personal opinion. You know, I think you could teach anybody something new as long as you got the right teacher in front of them.
What do you make of this fight, this trilogy fight? Obviously, going into, you know, Gennady's coming off the win over Morata, and Canelo's coming in off the defeat to Bivol. How's the fight stacked out?
Man, I think the fight is definitely an interesting one, and I think it's gonna be one of the. I don't think it's gonna be a trilogy as such as Fury and Wilder. I don't think it's going to be one of those trilogies, but it's going to be close. I think it'll be close. You know, I think it'd be close to that meaning that type of violent fight. I think it'll be a very violent fight.
Is it personal between those guys now? We hear them say no, but then the storyline indicates that it's otherwise, that it is personal.
I think every fight got to have a storyline. Without it, only us most loyal fans to watch. You know what I'm saying? But you trying to get your average everyday people to watch, you got to have a storyline. You know, is it personal for Canelo? That's what he said. Is it personal for G? He never said it was. This is business. And this is the next guy in line doing his business run. You know what I'm saying? But I mean, that's the storyline. They say it's personal. So some people say yes, some people say no. But one thing about it is that both persons will be in the ring that night, and both persons will give it their all to be successful. I have no doubt about that.
And just one last one. Obviously, Emmanuel was right involved in everything until right close to the end. Is this you now for the rest of your days? Are you going to be doing this until you can no longer do it?
Big time boxing?
Yeah.
Championship, or world boxing, championship level boxing? Yes.
You've got no desire to think 10 years, I'm going to have a couple of champions, make a nice couple of nice paydays and go and sit on an island somewhere. This is, you want to get in the gyms, you want to have your amateur boxing, your program in Detroit and give back, right?
I want to develop more and more talent because that's what the future is. Like, if we can't, like, no matter what happened, okay, or as you know, all the crime-ridden things, all that things happening in the city of Detroit. At one point, the Detroit newspaper, the Detroit Free Press, printed an article that says Emmanuel Stewart is pumping out champions like Ford is pumping out cars. Like, you can't get a bigger example, a higher praise. You can't get no better than that. That's what they said in the papers. You know what I'm saying? So, like, If I can somehow allude to that, if I can start developing champions out of that city, developing fighters out of that city, let's say they don't become champions, but they just become better functioning citizens. I'm ecstatic to even attempt to do that. You know what I'm saying? I'm trying to get a better environment than what I grew up in. My first interaction with the police was when I was in sixth or seventh grade, they threw me down to the ground, put a gun in my head. That was my first interaction with them. So I hated them. You know what I'm saying? But I don't want that to be the interaction of all these kids coming up. I'm trying to get other police officers, have an alliance with them to come to the gym, to work out. So when they see these kids in the street, they so used to seeing them that they don't see them as suspects. They see them as individuals. When the kids see the police officers, they don't see them as the enemy. They see them as people. And once we start seeing each other as people, then we start talking to each other like people. Now the conversation is, did y'all see what happened over there? Oh, yeah, I seen it. So-and-so's over there. You can talk to them. It just start making things better. And that's the one thing that I want to do. Because I didn't want to have no interaction with police officers. But I end up falling in love with a police officer. Sugar Hill.
Yeah.
Sugar Hill was a police officer. And when I went to court and seen him in uniform, I was like, oh my goodness. It was crazy, man. I'm like, what? Like, bro, why you gonna keep this a secret? You know what I'm saying? But it was the best kept secret, man, because I was able to look at police officers as individuals. I had no choice. I had to look at them as individual. I couldn't bunch them all up in one group. You know what I'm saying? And it's the same thing I'm trying to do for the kids like me from the inner city. When the cops see us, I don't want them to bunch us all up in one group. I want them to see us as individuals. So that's my goal with my community center, is to have that diversity there. Because I too want to leave an environment better than what it was when I walked in.
Hey, so, you know, from the conversation that we've had, Jonathan, it sounds like you have imprinted upon you and your future has been shaped by two people, right? By your mother and Emmanuel Stewart.
100%. 100%. You're correct. You're good listening, man. I like you. We could talk. We could talk anytime. You'd be listening.
Man, look, I appreciate you taking the time to speak to me. I know you're in camp, and I'm going to leave you to either your chocolate cake or your double chocolate cake, whichever one you prefer.
But, yeah, I'm not going to have one of those for months and months, so you don't got to worry about that.
Great stuff. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time, man. I'm grateful and all the best for
my pleasure. Thank you. And congratulations to you.
Thank you very much, man. Thank you.
No problem.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Great stuff there from Jonathan, who had a solid career in his own right and is now carrying on the legacy of the red and gold in Detroit. And I love his motivations and aspirations moving forwards. It would be easy to get to a point in life where you're either disillusioned or you don't want to do too much for other people. But that seems to be what Jonathan Banks is all about. And you've got to give him credit for that. I wish him all the best for the upcoming fight between Gennady Golovkin and Sal Canelo Alvarez. Very admirable Jonathan's qualities and his desire to give back. Quite often, actually, we talk about this sport, the politics, and what it takes from people. Obviously, I'm very aware that I've written Damage, which does, in no uncertain terms, tell you about what the sport takes from people. But you can also see with people like Jonathan Banks what it gives these people too. It gives them plenty back, plenty in return. These guys, obviously Jonathan there alludes to having issues with gang stuff and, you know, had a troubled path back in the day. And now look at him. That was a very wholesome example of what boxing gives to people and how it allows them to give back to communities and individuals. Well worth taking the time to speak to Jonathan Banks. Really appreciated his time. A reminder, guys, at patreon.com/Tristics, and you can get episodes early and advanced, and you can find more episodes of Ringside Rewind up there. I've got 6 in the can with Ian Dark and John Rawling. Some fantastic stuff there, talking about Calzaghe, Hatton, Ben Eubank, and there's a brilliant episode about boxing broadcasting, which is absolutely hilarious. Also, you can I mentioned it at the top of the podcast, you can pre-order Warrior, Matthew Saad Muhammad, A Champion's Incredible Search for His Identity. It is up on Amazon and via the Pitch Publishing website. So you can order that. You can pre-order that in advance. And huge thanks, as always, to my sponsors, Delco Safety Compliance. They're a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert, impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. We're also brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing, and they were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. Huge thanks to Dell and Blaz at Delco Safety and Hanson Lee. Huge thanks to Jonathan Banks. Huge thanks to you guys for listening. And we'll be back next week.